Hi, everybody. Today is Tuesday, July 8th, 2025, and our friend Scott Ritter is back with us. Welcome back, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with the BRICS summit here in Brazil. And in this summit, they talk about many issues. But here is what one of the core issues that Lavrov was talking about. Here is what he said, the new investment system and the way that they're trying to deal with it.
Has issued an initiative to create within BRICS a new investment platform that will take into account the new BRICS Development Bank. The carrying out of this initiative will allow us to create the new development bank and to turn it into an innovative instrument for development that would not be affected by outside agendas.
And here is the reaction
Scott from White House. Seeking to undermine the interests of the United States. It's the president's utmost responsibility to put the interests of the United States first. That's how he views his job as president. So he's going to ensure that America is fairly treated on the world stage, and he'll take any action necessary to prevent countries from taking advantage of the United States and our people. Raquel.
The concern about BRICS. Your take.
Well, first of all, let's talk about the BRICS summit and what it is and what it isn't this go around. I invite people to reflect back to February of 2022. BRICS existed. It was there, but it was a minor gathering, a form of some interest, but nobody was imparting, global dominance on this forum. Indeed, when Vladimir Putin flew to Beijing to meet with Xi Jinping on February 4th, and they issued their 5,000-word joint statement, basically declaring war on the West, economic war, saying that they oppose the rules-based international order and that they want to replace it with the law-based international order. The statement talks about three potential vectors that could be pursued in accomplishing this task. First was the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which was a mature entity, where there were already, institutionalized infrastructure of collaboration and coordination. The other was the G20, and again, a mature organization with the similar infrastructural development that helps facilitate the coordination of policy. And the third one was BRICS. But, BRICS wasn't first. In fact, one would say when you look at BRICS was last. But the conflict created a new geopolitical reality that could not be met or matched by either the Shanghai Cooperation Organization or the G20. And something new was needed. And so BRICS became the focal point. 2023 saw the BRICS summit in South Africa, where the expansion of BRICS was discussed. And if you study the history of expansion, discussions of it in BRICS, they talked about it, but there was really no enthusiasm for it because they really didn't know how it would work. And suddenly, overnight, BRICS is expanding. Why? Because BRICS has to become a broader platform, one that has more international appeal and international impact. So the expansion of BRICS became a reality. But again, it's moving very fast, very fast. You're expanding in an organization that's not structured to handle this expansion. Next comes Kazan. Kazan was supposed to be, and in many ways did serve as the coming of age of BRICS, continued expansion, but a new category of membership, a partnership. And then the beginning of the creation of this formal infrastructure of, the institutionalization, so to speak, of BRICS, which was carried out by Russia, in the form of just numerous ministerials that met in the lead up to Kazan, that established the interconnectivity and the need of collaboration and the mechanism of collaboration of the BRICS members. And now we have Brazil. 2025. What is the purpose of Brazil? You know, there's people who are saying, well, because Brazil isn't seeking to knock the ball out of the ballpark, BRICS is fading. BRICS is falling apart. BRICS is collapsing because, I mean, where's the expansion? Where's the, you know, where's the new currency? I mean, we need something new and all that. How about consolidation? How about BRICS having expanded not once, but twice, having created institutions? What about the consolidation of these institutions and the processes leading to a more mature organization that then can move forward? And this is what I think is happening in Brazil. So what I saw coming out of Brazil was, again, processes designed to encourage a collaboration and cooperation amongst them. And understand that Brazil was in a very tough position. A lot of people don't talk about this, but Lula was under a lot of pressure from the United States, not to cancel BRICS, but to minimize BRICS. There's a huge anti-BRICS platform inside Brazil, a pro-West, pro-American platform that doesn't want BRICS to succeed. So if you try to hit a home run in a ballpark where that has, 50% of the fans rooting against you, you need to be a little bit careful. And so I think what you saw was a constrained BRICS. So now that I set it up, when we look at what Lavrov was doing about the IMF or what Russia and China were seeking to do about, not a BRICS currency, but trading using national currencies, finding a way to make that not just possible, but viable as a counter to SWIFT and dollar dominance. These are projects that require intensive collaboration, intensive coordination, meetings, discussions, etc. And this is the purpose of it. Was it to stick a thumb in the eye of the United States? No, this is a gross overreaction. It shows the insecurity of the United States. Yes, there's no doubt that Lavrov was speaking about promoting the BRICS Development Bank as a counter to the International Monetary Fund, but it ain't there yet. It's not even close to being there. It's something that requires more discussion, dialogue, collaboration, coordination, which is what the purpose of bringing it up was about. The same holds true with the issue of, trade in national currencies. Again, it's not ready to compete globally as a counter to the dollar and SWIFT. It's something that BRICS is looking at themselves and doing. I think they said, 90% of the trade is done in national currencies now. Why? To a counter to irresponsible American policy, especially when it comes to the dollar and trade. So now we look at the United States response. I mean, Trump put out a childish letter threatening 10% sanctions or tariffs on all nations participating in BRICS, the bringing down America. I'll make the following prediction. I've been wrong in the past. Maybe I'll be wrong again. Not a single nation will give a damn about the Trump 10% tariffs. You're not going to see any alteration in policy whatsoever. First of all, my understanding is whatever he's threatening is going to be postponed until August 1st. So it's not happening immediately. Two, didn't Trump just threaten to sanction the whole world back in April? I mean, didn't he come out with the big chart that showed how he was going to sanction Russia, China, and the penguins? And yet he had to immediately turn around and give it a 90-day rest. He lied about, people kissing his ass to have trade deals. Nobody wants a trade deal with the United States. Why? What does the United States offer? Even look at how Trump responded. If I'm a businessman and I want to do business in Brazil, let's say, first of all, I have to have a mission statement, a timeline, a budget, and these need to be based upon predictable factors. So I have to look and say, okay, if I'm going to have a business X that's going to produce product Y, and I have raw materials, A through, U, how do I price it out? How am I going to, am I going to go out and I'm going to acquire the material? I got to bring in the shipping. I got to plan it out. All my financials have to line up. I'm borrowing money against this, et cetera. And then here comes Trump, who just starts throwing tariffs out that changes everything. No financial, no business plan survives the anarchy and chaos that Donald Trump puts out there. And so the choices are to either shut down or to ignore Trump and just say, screw it. We're going to go forward as if it doesn't matter. Ignore him. Ignore it. And that's what's happening. The United States has become irrelevant. I mean, Donald Trump can publish all the letters he wants. They'll get put out on X, and the Trump cheerleaders will put it out. This is the strongest American president ever. My God, look at the strength of this statement. 10% tariffs. The whole world trembles at the thought. The world doesn't care at the thought. And that's the strength of BRICS, because BRICS, as it matures, is providing a viable alternative, not just to the hegemony of America, but the inanity of America, the insanity of America. Predictability, that's something that Russian diplomats have been talking about from day one. They, you know, they laughed when they said, oh, we're trying to, you know, put the thumb on the scale of the American elections. And no, we just want predictability. We don't care who wins, as long as whoever wins, we know what their policy is. That's why many people believed that the Russians actually wanted Biden to win, because as bad as Biden is on policy, he is predictable. You're able to say, this is what Biden's going to do. Therefore, this is how we need to react. And this is the planning that needs to be done. It allows for coherence, et cetera. In comes Trump, who pretends to be your friend, but is really your enemy. And he's just jerking you all around. I mean, how do you weigh in that Trump is talking to Lindsey Graham about 500% tariffs on nations doing business with Russia, at the same time that Peskov, through Kirill Dmitriev, is talking about taking America off of the list of unfriendly states in order to create an investment opportunity to promote trade? I mean, Trump is just nowhere. I mean, he is everywhere and nowhere is nothing. And I think this is the reality of Brazil, is that the world's waking up to the fact that the United States is incoherent, the United States is incompetent, and that this just makes BRICS even seem better in a form that wasn't meant to actively promote BRICS because of the open hostility that exists in Brazil to BRICS. The exact opposite is happening. BRICS is looking like, you know, the foundation of sanity and stability, as opposed to the, you know, capital of chaos and anarchy that is Washington, D.C. under Trump.
Seems to me, Scott, as time goes by and Donald Trump tries with these sort of tariffs, that we know that BRICS, one of the main issues that they were talking about during this summit, it was the case of tariffs and how they want to respond, how they want to go against this sort of policy on the part of the United States. But it seems somehow I don't know if you know the term of quick clay, and we use in geotechnical engineering that it goes in quicksand, like quicksand, quick clay, and that's something mm-hmm. that swallow everything that goes. It seems that as these tariffs, as you've mentioned, if they're not working, what would be the next option? Are just considering doubling down on tariffs, or they're going to find, or maybe, as they call it, sanctions, which I believe tariffs and sanctions are the same, and there is no difference between them. You're taking the way that the United States should deal with BRICS.
Well,
or may deal, or somehow.
Well, I think, first of all, let's just take a look at the track record of the Trump administration. A lot of bluster, a lot of, you know, puffing out the chest, press briefings, bringing out charts that are meaningless. None of the charts he brought out have ever manifested itself into reality. His economic theories about the role played by tariffs, if you take a look at it, it's right there in the government, U.S. government's own websites. Tariffs will never supplant individual tax assessments as a source of income for the United States. Even though Trump ran on a platform saying, hey, I could get rid of individual tax in the United States, or just replace it with tariffs. Tariffs represent such a small portion of it, impossible to fully collect and predict. It's just stupid policy that alienates everybody. And then what happens when his bluff is called? For instance, China. He'll lie. I received a phone call from the Chinese. They're scared to death. They want a deal now. And the Chinese going, we never made a phone call. What are you talking about? We hit you with counter-terrorists that are destroying your economy. No, we need a deal. China's like, we've always been open to a deal. You know, let's, we'll have trade talks, but this time we got the Chinese in the position we want. The Chinese are going, we got you where we want. I mean, you know, I mean, this is the thing. This is all a grift, a giant grift. This is a scam being perpetrated on the American people by the greatest scam artist of all times, Donald J. Trump. And he's just out there blustering. The American people are too stupid, too lazy, or a combination of the two to see through this grift because we don't, I mean, my God, what can we understand about economy if we're willing to allow our nation to go into $36 trillion in debt and then applaud the bigger, better bill that brings it up to what, $42 trillion, $43 trillion, $45 trillion and growing, you know, and so Trump gets away with it because the American people are just being straight up front, ignorant, stupid. Dumb. So there won't be any accountability here in the United States. We're too stupid to know, you know, what's being done to us. Therefore, we're too ignorant to know what needs to be done to save us. The world, I think, will respond by, I mean, the United States is like, you know, we're too big to ignore. So they have to deal with us, but we're like that drunk uncle at a holiday that, you know, that sends everybody money at Christmas. So nobody wants to get rid of him because he's there, but he's really bad news. So we sort of push him in the corner and hand him a glass of beer and say, just do your drunk uncle thing here. And I think that's what the world's going to be doing in the United States. It's just basically, oh, Donald Trump. Yeah. We'll send our ambassador to talk to your guy, but you stay over there, America. You want to sanction us? Okay. Tariffs. I'm sorry. Yeah, sure. And meanwhile, we're going to have serious discussions with serious nations. What the United States should be doing is treating BRICS with respect. Because let's look at some realities. This is what I would be briefing the president on. First of all, shut up and never speak again. Let other people do the speaking for you. Become the silent voice behind the gloomy face that just stares and keep people guessing what's going through your stupid addled brain. Which, if they know the reality, is not much. Instead, look at Lavrov. What's he talking about? The creation of a bank to compete with the IMF. But it can't compete with the IMF right now. So what I would say is, let Lavrov and company think they have a bank here. What we need to do is turn the IMF into the bank they think they want to build. See, right now, the IMF is something that actually isn't doing its job properly. It's alienating the world. So it creates the potential of this other bank here. It makes it realistic. What we need to do is keep them focused on this because it's a waste of their resources and a waste of their focus and effort. And what we need to do is quietly, no press conferences, nothing, quietly transform the IMF into the bank that everybody wants to do business with. Word of mouth is so much better than just pounding your own chest, and turn the IMF into what BRICS wants to create. And then just tell the world, you don't need that. We're here. We're open for business. They're not even open for business. We're open for business, and business is good. And now, without attacking BRICS, you're undermining BRICS. The other thing is turn the dollar into the currency that the world wants to use. There is no BRICS currency because they can't build one to compete. So using national currencies, which by themselves can't stand up to the strength of the dollar. So what we need to do is stop using the dollar as a weapon and start using the dollar as the glue that holds the world together. You got a problem? Dollar. You got a problem? Dollar. You got a problem? Dollar. You need to trade SWIFT. Make everybody addicted to the dollar. It is literally financial cocaine because it's so easy. No other currency can be traded as easily as the dollar. We need to get the world addicted to the dollar. So the only way they're snorting the dollar is through SWIFT. And that has to be done by lifting all restrictions. I don't care if Russia trades with China using SWIFT, as long as they're doing it with the dollar. Because now the dollar is dominant again. And dominance doesn't mean that then we use the leverage. It's automatic. When people are using the dollar, they're turning to Washington, D.C. for the answers. And then our job is just give them answers to keep them addicted to the dollar. Right there, I just destroyed BRICS. I just destroyed BRICS, and it didn't cost us a damn thing. And I destroyed BRICS without saying, I'm destroying BRICS. I just made BRICS irrelevant because I made the dollar approachable. Well, see, in America, we're so busy trying to be seen as the global hegemon that we forget that if we just lead quietly and do the right thing, we will continue to be the nation that people turn to because there's no one that can do what we can do. China's got a big economy, but they're not as good at dealing with the world as we are. Even their Belt and Roads Initiative, it's got a lot of just bludgeoning in of, forcing themselves on because there's nations that need the help. The United States isn't giving it because the INF's a failure and we're weaponizing the dollar. So China steps in. But they're not as smooth as we are. We can easily compete with the Belt and Roads Initiative. We can easily compete with the Belt and Roads Initiative if we wanted to. But we don't. Instead, we badmouth it. And, you know, and it's like the problems where you, they say that there's no such thing as bad publicity. So every time we badmouth the Belt and Roads Initiative for a world that's already alienated to the United States, you're saying, what, America's badmouthing them? They must be good. Belt and Roads Initiative, come on over here. Instead, if we had the IMF and the World Bank and American, Department of Treasury people coming in quietly, just saying, what do you need? Debt forgiveness? We can do that. We got you covered. Restructuring of loan payment? We got it. No problem. Oh, you need to be able to trade with other nations? But yeah, we can open up the SWIFT thing too for you. You happy? Good. Sign here, 25-year commitment, low interest rate, boom, we own them for 25 years. And we treat them right. We don't walk away, but we treat them right. So they keep coming back to us. You know, this is the way we need to operate with the world. We need to be the better business partner. That's what I would advise the President of the United States. And shut up. You know, when things are good, some things just sell themselves. I mean, I don't watch that much TV anymore, but I'm fairly certain I don't see many Porsche commercials on TV. Why? They don't need to. Everybody knows what a Porsche is. And again, I might be showing how outdated I am. I don't know where Porsche, but I know the day when I was a young adult, Porsche was the car you wanted, or BMW. Didn't have to have advertising. You didn't need, Ford and Chevrolet and all the other commercials out there. If you wanted the best cars, you knew where to go. You went to the Ford, to the Porsche dealership, to the BMW dealership, Mercedes, and you got your car. They didn't need to go out there and sell themselves. If America was smart, we just become the partner that everybody turns. We don't need to advertise it. We're here. Hey, we need a loan. Come on in. We don't need to have Belt and Roads Initiative and all this kind of stuff. We just be America, the best partner out there. That sells itself. We're the furthest thing from the best partner right now. It would require a complete transformation on how we interact with the world, a reprioritization of things. But if you want to keep America relevant in the world today, America has to position itself to be relevant. And when you're the obstacle, not the solution, when you're the problem, not the solution, that's a problem. When people come to you and all they're getting is problem after problem after problem, sanction, tariffs, restrictions, etc. Who wants to do business with that? Nobody. And that's what's happening. We are rapidly, it's not even gradually, we're rapidly making ourselves irrelevant to the world because it's just too hard to do business with the United States. Who wants to do business with a narcissistic egomaniac that wants to sanction you and tariff you at every turn just because you expressed some sovereign independence? My God, you're not kowtowing, you're not kneeling to the American king? Well, then we will sanction you. When the approach should be, you can kneel whoever you want. Because I'm so damn confident in how good we are. It's like you come into my car dealership. It's my car. Well, I'm going to go shopping. Please go out there. Shop. Oh, here's coupons. Go shop here. We'll drive you around. We got a car. We'll take you to all the dealerships. You'll be back because this is the best deal there is. And it's a good deal. It's not just the best deal because it's the least bad. We're giving you a good deal, the best deal out there. And people will come back. People will come. And that's what America should be. We should be the place where the world comes to for solutions to the problems they face. But we're not. We're the problem, not the solution.
And the dominance that the United States is experiencing is because of the power that the United States dollar has and had and has been experiencing, has been somehow they try to do, Scott, they, when it comes to dollar and the way that they use dollar against other countries, as you mentioned, against Russia, China, tariffs, SWIFT system, you know, when the SWIFT system is goes, you're not, you don't have access to the SWIFT system, you're going to go bankrupt. You're going to go a lot of issues with the system. And do you feel that the dominance, is it important for the United States to save dollar? Geopolitical issues is much more important. I would argue if without dollar, the geopolitical issues are not that much important, just minuscule, nothing. And since you don't have the dominance in terms of dollar and how the dollar can be used for international communication, is that of concern for the United States, for the administration, or there are still people who are deciding about these things, are those political ideologues, political mindsets that they somehow feel that the geopolitical issues are much more important than saving the US dollar?
Well, I don't think you can separate the two. I'm in agreement with you that America's geopolitical posture is contingent upon the dollar more than anything else, even more than its military. The dominance of the dollar, the power of the dollar is what gives America, you know, its preeminent role in the world today. And I mean, we have a Secretary of State who, I don't think he realized it when he was saying it, but if you recall, when he was the senator from the state of Florida, Brazil was talking about starting to move to make payments, I believe, on the national currency as trade national currencies and to dump the dollar. And he did a press conference where he said, well, we can't do that. If Brazil dumps the dollar, then we can't control their economy. We can't control them. We lose control. We can't sanction them. The sanctions won't have any biting. And I'm like, the most honest statement made by somebody in a long time. And I don't think he realized just how honest he was being. And that's the thing. I mean, look at his approach on the dollar. It was a weapon. It's a weapon, a cudgel. Wrong approach. What we should have done is said, Brazil wants to trade in different currency. Why? How have we made the dollar inconvenient for Brazil? And what can we do to make the dollar convenient for Brazil? You know, because I'm a firm believer that the United States is capable of competing legitimately on the world stage with just about anybody. There are things we can't. I mean, that's okay. Yield that market. You know, as powerful as the American auto makers are, they understand they can't have 100% control of the market. You know, and so in competition's actually good. It's good to have some competition out there. And so the United States shouldn't be afraid of competition. We should encourage competition. We should just say we have to be better. And we have all the advantages. We have the dollar. But that wasn't the approach that that Rubio took. And that's not the approach anybody in the United States takes. The dollar is what gives us global supremacy. And so what we're doing is... And it's sort of ironic. We talk about how strong we are, but we behave as if we're very weak and insecure. Because, again, a strong person doesn't shy away from competition. You know, if I'm a good golfer, if my name is Tiger Woods and I'm golfing in the 1990s, you want to play a golf match against me on any course you want? Okay, I'll kick your ass. I'm Tiger Woods. I'm the best golfer in the world today. And statistically, I'm going to beat you. And that should be the United States. You want to compete with us? Okay, no problem. We'll outcompete you. And we'll do it honestly and fairly. We're just better than you are. And our approach should be then, you know, like Tiger, you know, you want to play better golf? Come here. Watch my golf video. Let me show you how to do the swing. You know, buy my merchandise. You know, people are like, well, how do we compete with America? come in. Let me show you how to do it. Okay, first of all, you know, we're going to put some American companies in your, you can come over here too, but you see, we lure you in, we bring you in, but we treat you with respect. And next thing I know, you're out there doing your thing, but you're a franchise of America. You're not really your own thing. You're a franchise, but you think you're your own thing, but you're not. That's how you control the world. And you do it with a smile on your face and legit and a pure heart. There's nothing wrong with that. But instead, we're so insecure. We're like that old saying that comes out of the, you know, the Middle East and other parts of the world. Maybe even the Iranians have something like that about, you know, my goat is, you know, if my goat is sick, then I wish all your goats to be sick or something like that. You know, basically, you know, if my goat's healthy, it's okay for you to have a healthy goat. But if my goat's sick, all of you need, your goats need to die, or sheep or horses or whatever. But that's what America's become. Oh, no. They're challenging the dollar. We must kill everything. Instead of saying, let's just make the dollar strong again. And America is insecure right now. And this insecurity will be our downfall because, you know, you project what you are. If you're strong, you project strength. If you're weak, you project weakness. And the way we're behaving with the world right now is not that of a strong nation. I mean, Trump's pretending he's strong. Strength. It's not strong to sanction. It's not strong to slap tariffs. If you're strong, you'd out-compete. But we can't compete. We're not in a position to compete. And I think the world's seen that. I mean, the world's not stupid. They know what a strong nation looks like, and they know what, you know, a floundering nation looks like, and we're a floundering nation today.
At the BRICS summit, they condemned the attacks on Russia and Iran. And Donald Trump, by the way, in his meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu, he said that he's going to send more weapons to Ukraine. Here is what he said, Scott.
More weapons to Ukraine?
We're going to send some more weapons. We have to. They have to be able to defend themselves. They're getting hit very hard now. They're getting hit very hard. We're going to have to send more weapons. Yeah, defensive weapons, primarily, but they're getting hit very, very hard. So many people are dying in that mess.
It seems that so far he approved 10 Patriot systems to be sent to Ukraine. And your take on what's going on with Donald Trump, and every time he comes out, as you mentioned, is somehow you don't see any sort of predictability. He says that he's not going to send anything, and then comes and I'm going to send because the fight is so bad and they're losing. They're just getting so it's a war. How do you expect that to end? And how do you want to put an end to the conflict by sending more weapons?
You know. The thing is, he's sending 10 Patriot systems that are supposed to be protecting Ukraine. First of all, what will they protect? Kyiv? All Russia will do is modify its approach to the aerial assault against Kyiv to one at a time take out the Patriot systems until there's no Patriot systems left in Kyiv. If this extends the war by another 5 months, I guess that's, you know, the Russians are okay with that. They're in no rush. There's no, you know, you don't see Vladimir Putin saying, we must win by this date. He's never said that. In fact, he said the opposite. You know, you have his negotiator in Istanbul. It took us 21 years to beat the Swedes. That's what it takes. We're prepared to go on for 2, 3, 5, 7 years, whatever it takes, but we're going to win. Pete Hegseth has been on it. We don't have that many Patriot batteries left to give. So now a political decision has been made to divert resources that we've already admitted we don't have enough of. We're going to divert them to Ukraine where they will be destroyed. They will be destroyed. They will not achieve the outcome the president wants. Meanwhile, on the battlefield, the Russians are just slaughtering the Ukrainians again. Are you going to take the Patriot and extend it over the battlefield? They tried that in 2023. With the mobile, you know, Patriot strike, and they had some success. They shot down some helicopters here, some aircraft there. But in the end, the Russians figured out and they destroyed the Patriots that were forward deployed. End of that experiment. So, you know, this is just the ignorance. And frankly, this is the weakness of Pete Hegseth. Because Pete Hegseth made the right decision. And what he should have turned to the president and says, Mr. President, I disagree fundamentally. All we're doing is guaranteeing the destruction of these patriots. We don't have a plan for their implementation. The Ukrainians don't have a plan. You're putting a Band-Aid on a wound that's much deeper than that. The only way that this gets resolved is through peace. And as you know, Mr. President, Zelensky is unwilling to negotiate on terms that he finds unacceptable, as long as he believes that, you know, we're going to continue to back him up. What we need to do is demonstrate to Zelensky that it's over. That you must, you know, concede important issues to the Russians. You have no choice. You're not going to win, and we're not going to lengthen this conflict. The other thing that it does is it buys time for Europe to, you know, think that they have the ability to, you know, reconstitute, or in some cases constitute from scratch, a viable defense industry. This will take years. You know, we you know, continue to use Ukraine as a vector for, you know, generating Russophobia in Europe, the fear of Russia that leads to a willingness to expend money to build a defensive capability that, you know, is unrealistic as it is unneeded. As I've said, he's just basically a glorified battalion operations officer. He's not even a battalion commander. He's a man who is a cheerleader for things he doesn't understand. He doesn't understand the Ukrainian conflict. He doesn't understand defense industry. He doesn't understand any of the complex issues that we're talking about. He doesn't understand Russia at all. But he is also the Secretary of Defense of a man-child who's the President of the United States. Donald Trump is a walking, talking embarrassment to America every time he opens his mouth. He doesn't speak like a leader. He speaks like a half-drunk, non-intellectual, and he writes worse. I mean, look, did you see the Japanese professor who took apart the letters that the White House sent out, all the errors it contained? Come on, this is the United States of America on White House stationery. Please, for God's sake, at least have control of your own language. But he writes like a child, because he is a child, and the people around him are children. There's no adults in the room at all. And so this is what you get: a narcissistic egomaniac whose feelings are hurt because his grand project to bring an end to the war isn't being played out the way he wants it. And so he's going to throw a temper tantrum and send more equipment to Ukraine, not knowing at all whether it's going to work. It's not. How much it's going to cost, he doesn't know. And what harm it's doing to America. His Secretary of Defense said, we can't afford to give it to him. We don't have it. And now we're going to give it to him, which means that the Secretary of Defense either was a fool before or a fool now.
How do you see the way that Europeans are talking about drones? And we've learned recently that Vladimir Putin said how effectively Russians were using drones against Ukraine. But when it comes to the long-term strategy, it seems that as time goes by and the manpower of Ukraine is getting weaker, it seems they're feeling that by drones they can continue, they can stay in the fight against Russia. Do you feel that, are we getting to this point that the attacks, if Ukraine fails to defend itself by their manpower, and as we know that they're failing right now, but what is the long-term strategy on the part of Europeans? And it seems that they're trying to convince Donald Trump as well, producing more drones and attacking Russia with drones?
I mean, there's no doubt there's been a revolutionary warfare, a revolution in warfare, modern warfare, and that revolution's come in the form of drones that dominate the battlefield today in a way that no other weapon system has in a long time. But let me just reintroduce your audience to certain realities. Back in the Napoleonic Wars, we saw armies advance in mass infantry formations. And this was the way that wars were fought up through the American Civil War, even into the Prussian Franco War in the 1870s. But World War I came, and we suddenly saw the advent of the machine gun. And we realized that we couldn't do massed infantry assaults anymore because we had a weapon system that would mow down infantry. So we had to change our tactics. The machine gun became a very important part of the war. It transformed the war. But we didn't get rid of the infantry. Infantry just changed their tactics. And the infantry continued to play a very important role in modern warfare, in the Second World War, in Korea and Vietnam, and every war going forward. The infantry is there. We've seen the infantry, supplanted in some cases by armor. The tanks, we saw air power come in and add a new dimension. But even with armor and air power and missiles, the infantry is still needed to hold the ground. So if you don't have infantry, if you don't have infantry that have adapted to these new realities, you don't have an army. Ukrainians are going to lose, not because they have incompetent drone theory. They have some of the best drone theory out there. They're very good at what they do, but that they don't have the infantry to hold the grounds, because the Russians have matched the Ukrainians in drone theory, and they're outproducing the Ukrainians with across the board on drone types. And so, the Ukrainian strategy for a while, or I should say tactics and operations, were to compensate for a lack of infantry. The Ukrainians used to operate with battalion strong points, but that became too expensive in manpower to do that. So they turned it into a company strong point, and it covered the gaps with drones, artillery, and things like that nature. That became too expensive, went to platoon, and now they're at basically squad and fire team strong points, 5 to 15 men holding a piece of ground supported with drones and such. The Russians aren't assaulting these 5 to 15 men with companies size formations. They're assaulting in what they call threes and sixes. Basically, they send a three-man assault unit to go up against a identified squad, Ukrainian squad or fire team position. They blow the hell out of it with artillery. They swarm it with drones, and they also swarm behind the scenes so that they suppress the Ukrainian drone operators who are supposed to be supporting this team. Once that Ukrainian unit on the ground loses its drone coverage and the Russians come in with their drones, and I'm talking about, again, it's the stuff straight out of a horror movie where the Ukrainians are in their bunker and you hear, and the drone comes in and kills them because there's no defense at that point. They can't suppress the Russian drone. And then the Ukrainians then become very combat ineffective, and three Russian assault troops come in and kill or capture or take prisoner the wounded people and take the position. This is the way the war is being fought, but you still need that infantry. If you don't have that infantry component to hold the ground, you're not going to win the war. And so, but we're learning the wrong lesson. You see, there was some success early on. The Ukrainians would, in the Pokrovsk region, for instance, they would just flood the zone with drones and make it almost impossible for the Russians to get to the front line and swap things out. But all the Russians did, is because there's a finite number of drones, is they went to the flanks, and then they started looking at this problem set. They do patterns of life analysis with their imagery to find out where the pickup trucks came from that are supporting this, how they communicate, where the relay stations are. And you see the Russians now, when they come into a zone, they'll put a wave of drones out there that hit all the relay stations. So all the communication relay stations that the Ukrainians have, they're gone. So now the troops can't communicate. The drone operators can't communicate. So now they have to leave their fortified position, come out in an exposed position to control the drones because they can't pass them off from one relay station to the next. And as soon as they come out, they're picked up and bam, the Russians hit them. The most dangerous job right now in the Ukrainian army is drone operator. They're dying by the droves because they can't survive. And once you clean them out, then the Russians pour drones into the secondary area, prevent reinforcement. And then they come in and they kill the guys in the front and they push it on. And that's the way. Right now, they're making advances in Pokrovsk. They may capture Pokrovsk soon by outflanking it, surrounding it, et cetera. Other regions as well are everything's falling. The Russians have solved this problem. But the West is always lagging. And so instead of focusing on what Russia has done, they're focusing on what Ukraine did. You see, they had observers there in Pokrovsk, and they went, oh my God, they flooded the zone. They stopped the Russians cold. So they went back and they started building drones and tactics, all that stuff. So now they're building a military that's outdated before it begins. Look at the British, 20, 40, 40. 20% will be infantry, et cetera. 40% will be new drones. The other 40% strategic drones. 80% of their military is going to be drone operated, because that means that they don't have to build a real military. They can fake it to make it because they're drone operators, but they're not. It's a joke. Drones have changed the way war fights, but at the end of the day, if you don't have the infantry to hold the ground, if you don't have all the other assets available to support the infantry, drones by themselves aren't going to change anything. And that's the reality of the modern battlefield. NATO in the United States is totally out of the picture because we're fighting the war that we want to fight, we believe is being fought. We're not fighting the war that's really happening.
Do you think that Russia would escalate, would somehow go on offensive bigger than before?
Well, escalate for what purpose? I mean, have the Russians changed their strategic objectives?
Because of sending more weapons to Ukraine, it somehow gives some sort of bad negative messages to Russians.
It doesn't give any negative messages. Again, Nima, go to Russia. There's no negative message to Russia. The Russians are committed to this war. They are committed to a collective war, not just against Ukraine, but against the collective West. They know what's going on. You know, if from the Russian perspective, let NATO, Europe, and the United States bankrupt themselves further. Russia has solved the problem of the front. I think last week or the week before, maybe last week, Russia suffered the fewest casualties in Ukraine that they have since the war began. 156 dead. That's a lot. Understand, during the height of the Vietnam War, America was sending 200 boys home a week, and that broke our back because we weren't ready for those kind of casualties. It ain't breaking the backs of the Russians. They're at war in their mind. Even though their government still calls it a special military operation, the Russian nation is at war. Vladimir Putin has successfully transformed this conflict into an extension of the Great Patriotic War, fighting the Nazis in Ukraine and fighting the supporters of the Nazis in Europe, to include a Fourth Reich in Germany that the Russians understand exactly what it is and what it wants to become. The Russian people aren't going to go, oh no, they're sending more equipment to the Ukrainians. The Russian people are like, bring it on. We're winning. We're going to win. We're not going to lose ever. So bring it on. And if it gets to the point where they escalate it, then the Russians are ready for escalation management. I mean, Germany may have to learn this lesson the hard way if they try to send in the Taurus. I don't think the Russians are bluffing about striking German targets. If that's the escalation they want, that's the escalation they're going to get. But Russia's not going to lose heart in this. The Russian people are behind the Russian government's objectives in this conflict. They recognize potential threat emanating from the collective West. And if the collective West wants to continue to send billions of dollars of equipment into Ukraine, so be it. That just means the Russians will have to destroy and kill that many more Ukrainians. That's it. That's the way the Russians are thinking. There's no deviation from this. There's no weak spot. Meanwhile, in the West, everybody's debating each other. There's no singularity of purpose here. How long do you think Europe's going to be able to sustain sending bad money after bad money after bad money in a failed investment in Ukraine? You know what the biggest tell is? BlackRock. BlackRock just said, there ain't going to be a Ukrainian reconstruction fund because there ain't going to be a Ukraine. They understand the reality. And that's the reality. If this continues, there won't be a Ukraine. Ukraine is over. Ukraine is finished. Ukraine is done. At least in terms of a Ukrainian nationalism point of view. As the Russians have said, as Vladimir Putin said, Ukraine's always been an extension of Russia. So we're just bringing it about the historical inevitability of the fact that Ukraine is Russia.
Here is, Scott, here is Ursula von der Leyen said about the support that Russia is receiving from Beijing, from China.
So my next point is on geopolitics. Security is more interlinked between the Euro-Atlantic and the Indo-Pacific than it has been in several generations. And it is evolving rapidly. So it is in our interest to work together. But we also know that China's unyielding support for Russia is creating heightened instability and insecurity for Europe.
Do they really believe that, genuinely believe that they can draw a line at this point between Russia and China with what they've been suffering, they've been confronting so far?
I mean, alcoholics believe that they can control their drinking, and drug addicts believe they can control the injection of consumption of drugs. So I'm sure the Europeans believe whatever they want to believe. But it's a fantasy world. I believe that they just had a meeting with, I think it was the Chinese foreign minister, where he said straight up, China's all in on Russia. We're not going to let Russia lose. We're all in. That's reality. He just gave words to the position China took as early as 2022. They're all in. It's one thing to get a scriptwriter to write a speech that you can deliver before the European Parliament or wherever the hell she was speaking. It's another thing to transform that into reality. Europe's got nothing going for it. Nothing. Can't do anything, can't accomplish anything, doesn't have a viable military, doesn't have a viable economy. They've become a joke, a literal joke. And the more they devolve and the weaker they get, the more they try to pretend and posture that they're actually something of substance. They're not. So it doesn't matter what she says. Not a single word that she utters matters. It's played to a European echo chamber and occasionally filters out into the American echo chamber, but not a nation in the world cares because she is irrelevant. Really, what can she do? Nothing.
I don't know if you watched the interview that Jake Sullivan had recently. It's on YouTube, and the guy is so amazing, Scott. When you imagine this guy was running the show, was running everything in the United States during the Biden administration, and the way that he's expressing his geopolitical views, and in the case of what's going on between the United States and China, Russia, and all of this, it's so childish when you look at him. He's not in that position anymore, but when he talks, you don't see any sort of depth in what he's talking about. It's totally on the surface. And do you feel that the same is happening with the Trump administration?
It's even worse. I mean, Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken were, byproducts of a neoliberal posturing by the United States that was consistent over time, meaning that he's not something that emerged in a vacuum recently. He's the byproduct of 8 years of Obama administration. Even before that, aspects of it came to maturity, the thought during the Clinton administration. And remember, for every action, there's an equal opposite reaction. A lot of the Obama administration's posturing, global posturing, was born of reacting to 8 years of George W. Bush and the neoconservative movement. So, in many ways, it's like Damascus steel. You get hardened, through continued exposure to heat. So Obama rolled in with, 8 years of Clinton, 8 years of hardening, posturing against the George W. Bush, then 8 years of uninterrupted Obama administration, and then 4 years of resistance to the first Trump administration, very active resistance, and then 4 years of Biden, in which, Blinken and Sullivan now came to the forefront. So the shallowness of his thinking was backed by, we're talking about, 8, 16, 24, more than a quarter century worth of, political maturity and development of this thought. So you're sitting there listening to him today and you're saying how shallow he is, but it is a byproduct of 25 years of American geopolitical thinking and progression. So we can be critical of it, but we have to understand that that's actually a more realistic reflection of the reality of America's geopolitical thinking as an establishment. Sullivan is not alone in the way he thinks. Now we get Trump. What does Trump have? Nothing. None of the people that surround him are serious people. They're all, amateurs brought in. I mean, they have the potential to be serious people, but, Marco Rubio, first of all, we have to understand what Marco Rubio is. He hates Donald Trump. He really does. Marco Rubio is a gift given to Donald Trump by Miriam Adelson. She wanted Marco Rubio, her husband wanted Marco Rubio to be the vice president, wanted him to be president. But Trump said no. So they gave him the consolation prize, which is the Secretary of State position. But if you think for a moment that Marco Rubio is, you know, a partner of Donald Trump, he's not at all. Who else does Donald Trump have in his circle? Pete Hegseth. It's a joke. Not a real Secretary of Defense. It's a flake. Scott Bessent, not a real Secretary of Treasury, just some person that was, you know, meaningless in the past and has now been promoted. Everybody in his cabinet has been promoted well above their pay grade. There's not a single person in the cabinet that's competent to do the job that they've been given, and it shows. And it shows. I don't want to go down the rabbit hole that is the Epstein, thing that's going on, but my God, talk about a self-inflicted wound. I mean, you have Pam Bondi, this attorney general, making high-profile statements to the press about, you know, what's going to happen. You have Kash Patel running, lobbying to be the FBI director based upon almost exclusively the red meat he throws the audience about Epstein files. Dan Bongino, the same thing. And now they come in and then overnight, it's suddenly not an issue. We're just supposed to forget about it. Maybe it's not an issue. Maybe there's nothing there. But my God, the incompetence shown in setting up that conclusion shows you that is the Trump administration in a nutshell. Everything they do is incompetent. Not a single element of competence out there. None. Zero. I mean, that's the reality. And that's what's so fundamentally embarrassing about all this, because we're a damn fine nation. Oh, we're not the best in the world when it comes to policy formulation. We've proven that. I just told you that you admit Jake Sullivan is shallow and he's the byproduct of 25 years of continuity. But, you know, normally when you have people like that, there is an establishment behind them that is rational and saying, well, hey, time out. Let's talk this through. Let's bring in some voices that might be able to mitigate against some extreme policies, et cetera. With Trump, you got nothing. Nothing. It is just shallow and stupid and ignorant, and it just manifests itself in that manner on a daily basis. I challenge anybody to show me 1 ounce of competence, 1 ounce of competence anywhere in the Trump administration, and you can't.
Donald Trump is meeting with Netanyahu, and he, while they're talking, and they're, I would assume, many issues in the Middle East, in the case of Gaza, Iran, all of this, we had an interview between Tucker Carlson and the president of Iran, Masoud Pezeshkian. Did you watch the interview?
I have to be honest, I haven't watched the whole interview because I just haven't had time. I've watched people have pulled out, you know, the key components of it. So, and then I've been reading the controversy swirling around the Iranian president's statement. So I'm familiar enough with the interview to at least try to talk about it in an informed fashion. But no, I have not seen it from A to Z.
And the main goal, in my opinion, that the president of Iran was somehow trying to say it was that the issues that Iran has with the United States is not the United States, it's Israel and Netanyahu, particularly Netanyahu, and he's trying to do everything to destroy any sort of talks between Iran and the United States. How do you find the way that he's trying to picture the situation? Do you think on the part of the United States, they're getting to the point, maybe Tucker Carlson is agreeing on that? He was trying to ask the question that many people in the United States would ask if they had the opportunity to ask, if they had the opportunity to talk with the president of Iran. But after all, the whole message of this talk was how to proceed with the current situation between the United States and Iran, how we can get back to the talks, how we can get back on track to find some sort of political and settlement, some sort of solution for the situation. Your take on what's going on between the United States and Iran in the current phase of the conflict?
Let's just start off with Tucker Carlson. And I have to say, there's, what do they say, in the interest of full disclosure, he and I have a rough history. There was one point in time on crosstalk after a particularly egregious performance on his part in front of a live audience, I threatened to punch him out on the stage because he's a lying sack of shit. And he is, and he was. And his position on Iraq was indefensible and is indefensible and forever will be indefensible. To his benefit, he called me up a couple of years ago and apologized. And we began to have conversations about Russia and things of that nature. And then he went silent again as he became the Tucker Carlson Network. And he's too cool for school. And, you know, I guess you don't want to have conversations anymore. But he went to Russia and had an interview with Vladimir Putin. And I was a supporter of the because I believe in dialogue and all that. But I will tell you, as a Russian expert, as a specialist in Russia, who's been studying Vladimir Putin my entire adult life, the interview that Tucker Carlson gave was incompetent, and it didn't further the issues meaningfully. It was a pure, you know, public relations display, and I even think in the aftermath, the Russians themselves were disappointed in it because Tucker Carlson was not the person to give that interview. I'll just ask you, could you have done a better job than Tucker Carlson formulating questions about the current situation? You don't have to answer, Nima. I'm going to give you the answer. And the answer is yes, you could have. You would have done a much better job because you have an understanding of Iran. You have an understanding of political reality of Iran. And you would ask questions that were relevant to that political reality. And you understand how Iran plays in the geopolitical stage and your questions. You wouldn't have come in as if you were an eighth grader doing a summer school project, which is what Tucker Carlson was. These were just stupid questions, amateurish questions. And unfortunately, the Iranian president wasn't as capable as Vladimir Putin in, you know, demonstrating the ignorance of the questioner. Instead, he gave answers that I think he was trying to appease Tucker Carlson. I think that was a major mistake, is in believing that by giving the answer he believed Tucker Carlson wanted to hear, that that's the answer that America wanted to hear, and therefore that the Trump administration would listen to these answers and act upon it. My take from the answers given by the Iranian president is he came off extraordinarily weak. Extraordinarily weak. And for Donald Trump, that's like putting blood in the ocean for a shark. Because once he smells weakness, he doesn't respect you. And Donald Trump didn't come out of this meeting, out of this interview, respecting the Iranian president. Far from it. He thinks that the Iranians are now rollovers and pushovers. Whatever image Iran was trying to put in as we stomped Israel, we're a strong nation, we're ready to do it again if necessary. We don't want to do it, but if called upon, we will do it. And we have our positions, they're hard. And if you want to negotiate with us, you have to respect our position. Take a page out of the Putin book, which is we're not going to yield on our position at all. And if you want to go to war again, we're ready to play that game. We don't want to play that game, but my God, we'll do it. And you know we'll do it. You know, you begged us not to hit a base full of Americans. We gave you every chance to get the Americans out. Next time, it ain't going to be that easy, Donnie baby. We're going to flatten your damn bases, and we're going to take your little friend Israel with us. We don't want to do it, but we're willing to do it. And we're able to do it. Trump will go, damn, because, I mean, you know, they're strong position, and they hit back really hard. I mean, that's how he thinks. But that's not what it was. It came across as extraordinarily weak. I'm not criticizing the Iranian president. I just think he was ill-advised. I think he was trying to do the right thing. I think he's actually legitimately interested in avoiding a conflict. And we know that. We know that he's the guy that stopped True Promise 3 when it was supposed to happen the first time. And we know that he's not been a fan of the IRGC hardliner position. And you never know. He may feel emboldened by the fact that, you know, a lot of senior IRGC people disappeared as a result of the Israeli actions. And he may be feeling a little bit more confident in the ability to flex his political muscles. I don't know what's going on in his head. These are questions I would have asked him, you know, put him on the spot, you know, what's, you know, but you know, I just think he came across as very weak. And I think that The other thing I would have pointed out, and it's the same thing I would have pointed out to Tucker Carlson, too. you're dealing with an American audience that is overly infected with Russophobia. And we're dealing with an American audience that's overly infected with Iranophobia. This interview isn't, just like the interview with Putin wasn't going to win over an American audience, you know, the average American, instantly. This interview with the Iranian president wasn't going to win over the American audience. Because, first of all, they're just too ignorant to understand what they watched and put it in a proper context. Instead, both interviews, Tucker Carlson's interview with Putin and his interview with the Iranian president now, should have been fact-based, hard-hitting interviews that created a foundation of intellectual thought upon which further discussions could be had. That everything going forward would be anchored to the Carlson-Iranian president debate. What did the Iranian president say? Carlson asked this question. Why did he ask that question? What is the context of this? Okay, boom, boom, boom. And now you're guiding it because that the interview would be treated with gravitas. Who's talking about Tucker Carlson's interview with Putin today? What academics are referring to it? It was a joke. It was a joke, a PR stunt with no gravitas, no substance. And the same thing happened with this interview. It's a joke. It's a nothing burger. No one's going to be talking about it in a week or two because it's like the wind, as opposed to if he'd come in and done the research, done the homework, hired Mirandi to brief him on these topics, to get into the essential essence of what Iran is, how the Iranian government functions, what's the role of the supreme leader, you know, in the decision making, what are the consequences to the Revolutionary Guard Command and conservative Iranians with the loss of so many leaders? Ask the questions, put the Iranian leader on the spot, make him give you answers. Instead, you threw out the softballs and the guy, he just hit them back and they were fielded. And it wasn't, that's my take on it. It wasn't a serious interview.
Yeah. Do you feel, Scott, that the situation in Gaza, Scott, is getting worse, and the pictures, the videos that are coming out from Gaza, it's somehow unbelievable to even watch? Here is what Donald Trump said in his meeting with Netanyahu about two-state solution.
I think that there can be a two-state solution that creates an independent...
I don't know. I'd ask Bibi that question. You have the greatest man in the world to answer that age-old question, two-state. Go ahead. You give him your honest answer.
I think Palestinians should have all the powers to govern themselves, but none of the powers to threaten us. And that means that certain powers, like overall security, will always remain in our hands. Now, that is a fact. And no one in Israel will agree to anything else because we don't commit suicide. We want life. We cherish life for ourselves, for our neighbors. And I think we can work out a peace between us and the entire Middle East with President Trump's leadership. And by working together, I think we can establish a very, very broad peace that will include all our neighbors.
Yeah, I assume he's talking about Abraham Accords, and he feels that he can get your take on what he said. Netanyahu said, not Donald Trump. She just gave it to Netanyahu the opportunity to respond.
I don't think the solution to the problems manifest in the Middle East was resident at that table. I don't think Donald Trump is intellectually or morally capable of formulating sound policies on Gaza. He doesn't understand the true extent of the problem, and he's surrounded by people who are just sycophantic in their approach to Israel. Israel first ever across the board. I mean, it's embarrassing as an American. And Netanyahu, we're talking about a literal war criminal, a practitioner of genocide, articulating a posture that's Israel first, greater Israel, unrealistic. What I would point out is on the eve of that meeting, Netanyahu was sat down by his people and he had to read the report of continued resistance on the part of the of Hamas. A successful ambush against the IDF, against one particular battalion in particular, the 97th Battalion, which is full of the just psychopathic religious Jews who have raped, murdered Palestinians. In fact, they're so bad that even the Israeli government's like, these guys are just too bad, because all they do is kill Palestinians. They rape them. And it's just, we need to, so bad that we were going to sanction, we, the United States, were going to sanction them. We were going to sanction an Israeli army unit at a time when the Israelis are committing genocide. That's how bad this unit is. But the, you know, they were hit hard. Before that, another unit was hit hard. Hamas isn't going away. I mean, Hamas is not going to surrender, float away, disappear. And Israel's not going to beat Hamas. That's the reality. And, you know, however long it takes, the Netanyahu government will end one day. My guess is they will end before Hamas yields. Would Hamas like a ceasefire? Absolutely. But a ceasefire to bring humanitarian goods and not to delegitimize Hamas. But we're at a horrible point in this conflict. Because we're at the point where the world has become immune to Palestinian death. I mean, it's just the reality. I don't mean to be harsh about this. I predicted this for some time now. Even somebody like me, who has forced myself to look at the dead bodies every day, it's just, if you're shown it every single day, the same bloody images all over again, at some point in time, they just meld into one and you become numb to it all. That's where we're going to be for some time, I believe. I think the world has come to accept the fact that the Israelis are committing genocide, mass murder, and the United States is facilitating it, and Hamas is going to continue to resist. Until something changes fundamentally, I think we're trapped in that model. You know, Netanyahu is going through some very difficult times inside Israel, politically, and maybe even criminally. So maybe he'll disappear and maybe there'll be that kind of change. But, you know, when you talk to the Israelis, everybody's waiting for Netanyahu to go. But the fact of the matter is, the majority of Israelis continue to support the genocidal policies that he's perpetrating against the Palestinians. Yes, they want the hostages to come home, but that doesn't mean they suddenly have an affinity in their hearts for the people of Gaza. Palestine will only be born on the ashes of Israel. That's a reality. And given the fact that the United States is populated today by a government that is unabashedly pro-Israel, which means pro-genocide, which means for facilitating genocide, there's not going to be any movement towards a Palestinian state for 3 years, or maybe two. Maybe midterm elections can achieve some sort of result. But, you know, there has to be a change in the mindset of the majority of Americans, that MAGA, make America great again, is not synonymous with MIGA, make Israel great again, that Israel is not a friend of the United States, that Israel is an enemy of the United States, that Israel is causing the United States harm. I don't want to get you in any trouble, but I would just say this. During World War II, you Americans would have no problem screaming out death to the Japs after Pearl Harbor, or death to the Nazis. And I think you see where I'm going on this one. I'm not going to say it because I don't want to get you kicked off of YouTube. But, the fact of the matter is there's legitimacy to that cry, because we're talking about a military organization that is committing, by their own admission, committing mass murder, luring Palestinians in to shoot them as they go to get food because the Israelis perfectly starve them to death. Shooting them as they go to get water because the Israelis deny them water. Shooting them as they go to get medical care because the Israelis deny them medical care. That's the reality. Every day, hundreds of dead Palestinian civilians murdered by the Israelis. The world is waking up. You know, the only question is, when will America wake up?
Thank you so much, Scott, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you. I wish we could find, you know, like nice topics to talk about sometime. Wouldn't it be nice to talk about, you know, hey, Nima, peace broke out. Oh, no. How did that happen? But you know.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Thanks.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
Yeah.